Okay, I'm assuming we're just going to triplets, we're going to deal with that. My name is Rachel Gilson. I live off center, I'm crew staff, I serve on the theological development and culture team led by Keith Johnson, specifically giving leadership in LGBT engagement. And we have 1 hour together, which will be completely sufficient to solve all the problems and questions in this topic for all time. So I just want to congratulate you in advance for being experts at this session. If you have had any questions at this time, I would encourage you to go on staff web and use the search box and type in LGBT. We have a whole website that has lots more stuff that I helped put together, and I only know how to find it by using the search bar. So I can be more specific, except I can't. For those of you who like a roadmap of where we're going, I'm going to share a little bit of my story with you. We're going to cover a little bit of a positive frame, what the Bible has to say about this topic. We're going to talk a little bit about what it means to be loving to our LGBT friends and families and neighbors. And then we'll probably have time for half a question. I don't know. It's just an hour, so it's a little bit of all that. So like some of you in the room, I am not straight. And like some of you in the room, I didn't grow up in a Christian household. So haven't I appeared exactly, that's part of the story. So I grew up in a considerable area of Southern California, but my family was not churchgoers. By the time I got to high school, I really had nothing to do with faith at all. So on the one hand, I thought that religion, specifically Christianity, was for people who didn't know how to think for themselves, and you know, people who needed an intellectual crutch. And I thought I was very intellectually sophisticated as a 16-year-old. So even just Christianity on that end didn't appeal to me. Now on the other side, I also discovered in high school that the way that most of my female peers were talking about boys was actually how I felt about girls. So I had some dating experience with guys, and I liked guys, but every time we got to that place of, you know, romantic or sexual connection, and again, my parents probably should pay more attention to me. I shouldn't have been thinking about this as a 14-year-old. But every time I was engaging with guys in that way, I thought, ugh, this is a little icky. And you could be thinking, well, maybe you shouldn't have been hooking up with teenage boys, and you're not wrong, right? But as I started to explore my sexuality, I realized I was more at home with women. Because I had no moral framework, I really had to stop and ask myself, well, is this okay? Because you remember, so just to give you a little chronology here, this was like in 2001. This was before any of the states that legalized same-sex marriage. This was when Will and Grace was still edgy, not nostalgic, you know, so this was a little different. But I couldn't find anything in my worldview that would tell me that loving other women was wrong. And so I thought, okay, well, I'm just going to go for it then. But I also realized, without ever having been personally mistreated by a church or by a Christian, that Christianity was opposed to my sexuality. So not only did I think of Christians as stupid people, but I also thought of Christians as bigots. So it's really not, you know, hanging out with stupid bigots, not really like your idea of good time, spending your life, right? So I was accepted into Yale College, which was, I was in Southern California, that was in Connecticut, and I accepted because I didn't realize how terrible winter is, and I was very excited to come home. I just didn't show up with a coat or anything, you don't understand. And I had really established my identity on these two pillars. One, my intellectual excellence, and two, this girl I was dating at the time who I was accepted. And I was excited to be at Yale because I thought, finally I'm going to be in a place of ideas, finally I'm going to be in a place where I'm going to be able to explore my sexuality freely. And God in His kindness blew me up. So, one, this is a little first pillar, if you go to a mediocre public high school, you will not be the smartest person at Yale. Like, yank that right out. I was like, oh no, I'm not smart enough to be here. Which actually ended up with a whole 4 years if you can let. one thing that happened. The second thing that happened was my girlfriend that I was dating at the time left me. This is embarrassing, but I'll share it with you. She left me for a guy who hadn't graduated high school and who lived in a van. But not even like a fully functioning van. The van had to start getting rolling down the hill first before the engine could be. It's really embarrassing to be left for that guy. It's like ever, right? So I was what you could call depressed. Yale's policy is that they do not let you stay in the dorms over Christmas break. And so I had to be kicked out of my house. So the only place I had to go was to my now ex-girlfriend's house in Lake Tahoe. So I spent my Christmas that year. It was Christmas morning. I was reading Don Quixote on a futon, hearing her have sex with her new boyfriend in the other room and thinking, this is the worst Christmas ever. It was really sad. It was a lot there, didn't it? I'm not laughing at this. So, I really went through what was functionally an identity crisis. I didn't have her. I didn't have my so-called intellectual superiority. So when I went back to Yale, I was just trying to find things to fill out who I was. So I was like, okay, maybe I could write for school newspapers if I was smart enough to write for school newspaper. Or maybe I could go to the gym more if I was definitely too lazy to go to the gym more. But never say, oh, I need Jesus. Like, Jesus was not, he was not in the picture at all, right? So I happened to be sitting in lecture one day, we're going through Western philosophy, and we came upon a dead European who invented the phrase, I think, therefore I am, which he probably heard. And from that starting point, he creates a whole proof for God. And I remember sitting in the auditorium thinking, this is a really stupid proof for God. But as I was sitting there, it was like in my mind, I suddenly was thinking, well, what if there's God? And immediately the other part of my mind is like, no, we don't think that way. That's for stupid idiots. I'm like, well, you haven't thought about this since you're like 15. Maybe you should back up a little bit and just back and forth. And so I did what everyone does. I asked the internet. So again, 2004, so you need 2 hands to open your laptop, and I was just firing in. Religious terms. I don't know why I never text the internet with important questions, but I kept coming back to reading about Jesus. But I was so embarrassed to be interested in it that, like, my roommates came in, I would slam the computer like a kid cobbling a form on a family computer or something. I was very embarrassed. But as I was reading about Jesus, I kept getting drawn in. It was very surprising to me. My vision of Jesus, I sort of thought of him like George W. Bush wrapped in a toga or something, and it was not to me. But one of the first things that drew me to Jesus was that when he would have opponents come ask him tricky questions, he could just shut them down. And I was like, that is amazing. I don't know if it's like a character deficiency, but that's the part of him I was drawn to first. But then there were clearly also pieces of Jesus where he was just so tender with vulnerable people. And I was not tender with vulnerable people at all. I would pick on people. I made this girl cry once in high school just for fun, making fun of her face. I was like, ooh, interesting. But I couldn't deny that I was interested in Jesus. It made me feel sneaky, but I couldn't get past it. But I also knew that my sexuality was like a barrier. The only two people at Yale who I knew who identify as Christians were these two girls who were dating each other, and one of them was training to be a Lutheran minister. So I thought, great, so they're clearly going to know how to deal with all of this. And I absolutely met them in marching band, and I absolutely never did cool. So I approached them, and I was like, hey, so how do you reconcile these things? Because I thought that they maybe didn't go together. And they were like, oh, yeah, it's all been a big misunderstanding. God is totally for when I'm just saying that's the relationship. I was like, oh. And they were like, here's this packet of information. I love a packet. So I put that one down. I was ripping through it and it had this internal logic that made a whole lot of sense. But when I pulled on my computer the Bible verses it was claiming to interpret, I kept thinking, no, these don't match. Now, I'm not good at hardly anything, but like, one of the only things I'm good at is reading. I thought I was a Bible scholar, but I was just like, I don't think David has a man problem. I think he has a woman problem. Like, I don't know. There's dorm trash can, you know, the point where it falls over because I pick myself up and I'm not gonna hold it back. And I thought, fine, I have nothing to do with this. But sometime after that, I happened to be in the room of a friend who was a non-practicing Catholic, or as I can count it, most Catholics in New England, just Catholics. I was in her, I was standing in the doorway one day, she was getting something out of her room, was just standing there, and she had a bookshelf next to her doorway. And I love to judge people by looking at their books, so that's what I'm doing. And there was one title, Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. Mm-hmm. Oh, young girls, right? I didn't know I gave C.S. Lewis.
Feel that desire to understand why
But I think one of the important lessons that God pressed on me in those first couple of years was, one of the most important question isn't what is being said or why. What if the most important question, who's the one who's asking? Because if I will only obey when I fully agree or I fully understand, then how am I not making myself God? It reminded me of a story I had recently introduced to of the first people who lived in a garden. Because God created Adam and Eve to put them in the garden, and it was wonderful. Anyone that tells you it's perfect or wrong, it was wonderful. And you can imagine a situation where God gave Adam and Eve one rule, and it was, here's your one rule. Adam, don't kill your wife and only friend Eve. Right? Because murder as a prohibition makes sense to us. Like, it's icky, it's taking an image bearer. It just feels intuitively right to us that murder would be wrong. We would look at that rule and say, yes, very good rule, God. We would have told ourselves we would obey, but I don't know, probably not. But God actually said, here's your one rule. Don't eat the fruit from this tree. By the way, the tree is related to the knowledge of good and evil. Don't eat this one. You can eat everything else, just not this one. Like, even vegans eat fruit. You know what I mean? There's nothing in this rule on the face of it that makes it by itself make sense as to why I should have this. The only way you can obey something that doesn't make sense is if you trust the one who's asking it of you. I think there was a genius in the Lord setting the commandment this way because it would force the people he made, force his image bearers to ask, is he tricking me? Or can I trust him? Especially when we come to these most intimate places, like, is he tricking me or can I trust him? Who has he shown himself to be? And when the serpent tempted Eve, he asked her to use all her data to just think about the rule, cut out from the relationship. She was like, well, it looks good, it probably good to eat, desires to make me wise. And so she ate it and Adam ate it, and here we all are downstream, not doing so great, right? There's such a tendency to abstract God's rules for who he is. We just can't do that. No matter what topic we're thinking about, but especially a topic as tender and as personal as sexuality, we have to root in his character. And I think what God has to know over and over again is that Jesus Christ has proven that he's trustworthy. And it's not just that he died, although that does make him trustworthy, it's that he came at all. He didn't owe me anything. He could have stayed in Trinitarian bliss. I would die and stood in front of him, and my sin would have been cleared, and I would have said, yeah, you have to condemn me. Like, that's the only way you're good. But Jesus chose to be sent by the Father and to live a miserable life, like born into poverty, into an oppressed country, born before Instagram, born at a time when his father, Joseph, doesn't seem to be alive later in life, so he probably helped raise his younger siblings with his mother. By the time he's a grown-up, he's homeless, all of his friends are idiots, and the people who should first recognize and worship him go on a years-long tirade to try to have him murdered and succeed. And his death is terrible. Like, no one does this unless they're trustworthy. No one. So I want us to be grounded as we think about this issue, because for some of us, the why is really difficult. To remember that at the core of it, God has revealed that he is for us. Not just in some abstract way, but really for us, and that we can trust him, even in places that are hard. Now, I do think that there's a way that if that is the only thing God had ever given me, I could have been okay. It would have been enough. But I also think that God has given to us, in the scriptures, a lot of data to help us understand why he's doing what he's doing and what he says about sexuality. Sometimes when we hear the things he says no to, especially for some of us when we hear the no to same-sex sexual relationships or lust, we can feel like, oh, there's just no feel so arbitrary or so cruel. We know God's character isn't arbitrary or cruel. I think sometimes we can focus too much on the five scriptures that say no, when actually God has also laid out a positive vision for what he's doing with marriage and sexuality. There's a little story. So I've got a friend named Sam. He has a friend who loves to host people. And this buddy of his is kind of a jokester. So he moved into a new apartment. And he discovered this spoon. It had like a perfect hole where like the bottom of the spoon should be. So you're like looking at it thinking, this is literally a useless spoon. It cannot do anything that a spoon is required to do. And so since this buddy was kind of a jokester, he decided to put it in his sugar bowl. He was British, so he would often have people over tea. He could just like stand at the side and watch his guests try to use the ridiculous spoons. So, you know, they'd like open it up and pan. And some of them would try to take a little bit of sugar on the side and fling it into a cup of glass. He claims that the Americans would really laugh. They say, like, hey, I'm going to have a stupid spoon. You know, like, I don't know, it's an anger. But one day, I opened up the jar and pulled out the spoon and said, why do you have an olive spoon in your sugar bowl? And he was like, what? So you know how olives are sold in like that jar of goo? Right? So apparently the spoon is designed so the hole allows that nasty liquid to drain off. And then you just have your olive up above. So, you know, if you stick the spoon in, take your nasty olive, goo runs off, and then you can eat the disgusting. I don't know, olives are nasty. God's trying to set forth and communicate with. We have to understand that walk through these things, all of us are sexually broken, and all of us wreck this image all the time. Okay, so first we have faithful and forever. But the second thing that God has built into marriage in order to help us fulfill its purpose is that marriage is designed to be a place of sexual pleasure. We have to remember, of course, that sex wasn't our idea. It was God's idea. It's not like he looked down one day and was horrified at what we figured out to do with our bodies. He's the one who designed our bodies. And in fact, there are whole sections of scripture that have nothing to do necessarily with procreation, which we'll get to soon, but actually just have to do with the joy, the intimacy, and the pleasure of what the sexual bond is supposed to be. Because the whole book, Song of Songs, is about this love and this pleasure. Like, Orthodox Jews are not even allowed to read it until they're 40, which for us is a little weird, because you're like, oh, your teeth is like a flock of goats, doesn't mean that we get our cars racing, right? So, just gotta get into the imagery there. So God's not a prude. He designed it this way, and the reason he designed it this way was because his relationship with his people is supposed to be intimate and pleasurable. I would, in fact, argue that even if you are single, your experience of sex drive has put into you, like a homing beacon, the strength of it, the endurance of it, the way that it can take over your whole windshield is supposed to be a vision of how much God longs for us and how much we should long for him. So sexuality is not wasted if you don't happen to be in a marital state. But again, there's been a lot of brokenness around this good thing that God designed to be in marriage, and who's probably broken it more? Straight people or not straight people? Just statistically, like just in the numbers, right? I mean, I think all of us have been somewhere along the spectrum of brokenness here. We've either had sex outside of marriage, abused pornography, or we've been sexually abused. I mean, there's a lot of ways that this can go wrong. And that breaks God's heart. It's not how he designed it to be, right? So we're first got, again, faithful, forever fidelity. We've got sexual pleasure. Number three, the gift of procreation. Like, procreation is designed to happen in the context of marriage. It's like an incredibly beautiful thing that part of the way we energize that with our bodies, we can create an eternal being. I mean, it's kind of insane. On a bad night, for 3 minutes, you have something that will never go away. Like, that's crazy. It's only half a day. So, the reason God designed this picture of him and his people to be a place of fruitfulness is because his relationship with us is supposed to be fruitful. It's supposed to produce new life and about people being born again. It's also supposed to produce transformed life. And again, if you are single, you are not cut out of this vision. But when God told Adam and Eve, be fruitful and multiply, subdue the earth, that really just gets transposed when Jesus gives the command to go into the world and make disciples. That all of us have access to being spiritually parents. And try to be spiritual reproduction, right? So that there's multiple ways to produce and see this fruitfulness in life, but that procreation is designed to be part of this package because it communicates powerfully about what God's relationship with people's life. We've got those three, and for the most part, that's what culture and the church have decided that marriage is. Well, like kids, if you can afford them, or like them. Natural, understanding dogs, I don't know. Only if we say that this is all marriage is, these first three things, no wonder we felt flat-footed when it comes to about same-sex marriage. Because of course two men can be faithful companions for life and have meaningful sexual relationships. Of course two men can have that. And yes, they can even adopt children and raise them up in safety and protection. So if that's all we say marriage is, we get caught a little bit. Part of the reality is this least intuitive fourth good that God's built into marriage is sex difference. That is that there is a male party and a female party. Just imagine a male party, right? Male party, female party. And this one can feel non-intuitive for many of us, but it's clear. Whenever God uses the image, Genesis Revelation, it's always this male-female pairing. God is always male, and his people are always female. And I think what's important about this, it's not like the authors of the Bible were just scratching this picture of being afraid to use feminine language about God. There are places where God talks about nursing Jacob at his breast, or carrying Israel in his womb, or fretting about his people like a mother does. Because a mother is a very accurate little picture of the type of love God has. It's not appropriate. God will use female language sometimes when it's appropriate, although he does almost always, in other cases, refer to himself as male, so he should be polite and use his preferred pronouns. But there's something happening here. Something that's happening is this love across difference. That there is something fundamentally different about male and female, which signals a much bigger difference between God and his people. But that there's a difference because of the work of Christ. There's able to be unity. There's able to be something powerful there. And we see this over and over again. In the Old Testament, God is a faithful husband, and his wife is unfaithful. You know, I don't know how many of you have done a quiet time in Ezekiel 16 recently, but it's a little graphic, right? But then because of the work of Christ, we suddenly see in the New Testament that God remains the faithful husband, but his people are not able to be the washed and faithful bride. And it's beautiful. And so sex difference is clearly all along the way definitional to marriage. And we've lost sight of that a little bit in our culture, but it's right there. Even when Jesus in Matthew 19 gets asked a question about divorce, he goes out of his way to affirm that marriage is male and female, even though that's not what he's directly asked about. But don't we also know, just because a marriage exhibits sex difference, it's broken in all those other ways, it's not necessarily doing its job of representing what God wants it to represent in the world. The metaphor really needs to contain all four things if it's going to communicate the beauty about who God is with his people. And so I think, too, as ministers, as we're thinking about how to relate to this topic, I want to be more conversant in what God says yes to, that we're able to create a beautiful vision, and not just talk about what God says no to. Because I think people are going to be able to latch on to his goodness and what he's designed if we're conversant and say yes. I hope, too, this will also allow us to begin in such a way that marriage is held in honor and that singleness is held in equal honor. There's a way in our culture where somehow we've decided that marriage is varsity level and singleness is JV. When you read Paul, it feels a little bit like that should actually be reversed. Where there can be this thing in queer culture that society says you are not a full or complete adult unless you have a romantic partner. And crew has said, yeah, we agree with that, not just crew, the church in general. We agree with that so long as it ends in marriage. So there can be this way that, like, all the kids gather in for summer project, like you're on the campus team, right? And we say, baby, you're sitting next to your future spouse. As a finding partner is the reason you come on mission. Right? Or we can start to treat people who are single of a certain age as if maybe something's wrong with them, and we desperately try to pair them up. God created marriage to be an extremely good and beautiful thing. He has also created singleness to be an extremely good and beautiful thing. To be a single person in our culture, especially if you are not straight, declares with your whole life, I believe in the resurrection, and I'm going to stake my life on it. And I think there's something that those of us in America can learn from that. That marriage is just this little thing designed to point to the real marriage that's coming. When the new heavens and the new earth come, we will all be single, and we will all be married. Both these life white stages are our plan to be pictures of the goodness that God's building for us to come. Okay? And so some men are like, oh, I don't want to be part of the bride of Christ because it's girly or whatever. You know, women are called sons of God, so it all equals out. So we have a difficulty in church where sometimes we have thought, well, if I'm doctrinally correct, then my whole situation is fine. I agree with God that marriage should be male and female. Hopefully you agree on the other things he says marriage should be too. But then we forget about how we're actually treating people. And I would argue that theology is all of it. It is doctrine and it's how we behave. Right, so I think this is why Jesus rebuked the doctrinally perfect Jewish elite with a story of a good Samaritan. A Samaritan was a heretic. He was theologically wrong. But his actions were completely right. And Jesus said, go and do like a heretic. Jesus is clearly not telling them to be doctrinally sloppy. But shouldn't we, of all people who have our doctrine in line, be the most loving? Actually, the church has been some of the least loving people to the LGBT community. I mean, still today, 2019, there are kids who are coming out to their parents. I mean, just saying that they experience anti-Semitic attraction, not even necessarily saying that anything's happening, who are getting kicked out of the house by their Christian parents and having their money for college taken away. I have a friend named Bill who ministers in this space and likes to say, the gospel of exclusion has no power to save an already banished people. That's sort of consistent with what the church has done. We make the church unhealthy for single people in general. And then we also say, if there's even a whiff of value of this attraction, or if you're faithful but you don't look quite right, stick on, right? This is an abominable rejection of the gospel. There is none of us in this room who accepted the gospel after we already agreed with God or had been all together. There's not an unsaved gay person in the world whose problem is that they're gay. The problem is that they're unraveled out of the one who made them. So when we reverse that, we do great damage to an interfere and great damage to our witness. So again, from Bill, I'm like, it's four again. I don't know if you like four, especially a bad number in China. So I don't know what that will So Bill offers four things that how we can relate to the LGBT community in a way that is full of grace and truth and offers it to you. So number one is invite. And this doesn't just mean like invite to your Christian events, although it does, if they're safe, invite them. But it also means invite your LGBT friends and family and acquaintances into your life. Invite them over to dinner. Invite them to coffee. Invite them to help you with a project. Like, invite, 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 invite. Because how can you possibly love someone if you're not spending time with them? Remember, Jesus spent so much time with the irreligious that they started calling him by their names. There could be a way that you spent so much time with the LGBT community that people slander you. But the Lord knows, right? We invite, you don't, Christ is our judge, not anybody else. We invite. We also listen. I love the way Bill phrases this. He says, ask the next honoring question. So you want to ask your friends all kinds of things. Do you have any spiritual history? Like, what's that been like for you? Ask them about things that have nothing to do with your sexuality. Right? Ask them about their relationship. Ask them about their jobs. Because they're full people. We're full people, but, you know. If you have a good enough relationship, you can ask them about what their journey with their sexuality has been like. You know, like, when did you first discover this? Like, how has this been for you? And you're asking this Bible answer in your head. Why we're asking just to know, just to hear, just to love. It's a deep thing to have someone share that part of their life with you. You don't want to ask expecting if you deserve an answer. But there's a way to ask to invite, to demonstrate what you want to know and you want to love. So we invite, we listen, we protect. There are some of us who are still in contexts where gay jokes fly around like crazy. This just dehumanizes people. It can be an easy step for you to say, like, oh, hey, man, that's not cool. Right, to have zero tolerance for language like that. One way that we can protect is by figuring out what language is harmful to my gay and lesbian friends and what language is helpful for them. So, for example, the word homosexual no longer communicates that you're paying attention to this conversation. It sounds old and weird and conservative, and you say it for your life to say bye. And I know, too, some of you might be thinking, oh, it's so hard to stay on track with the language conversation. And it can be hard because things do change, but love is hard and love is worth it. And its mission is all people understand that the language that we use is a primary way that we need to communicate and show love. So, for example, you don't want to use the phrase gay agenda. We don't want to see an email on Monday morning looking at our actions. You don't want to use the phrase gay lifestyle. It sounds like this is a thing that I just practice sometimes as opposed to like a deep and vulnerable part of who I am. Another one, you know, people love to use the phrase love the sinner, hate the sin. The problem is the church started using this phrase because they wanted to say, I care about who you are. I don't necessarily agree with how you're living, but I care about you. They want to create a separation there. The problem is that phrase has been used in harmful contexts or by people maybe didn't even mean quite that. And so whenever a gay person hears that, all they hear is, I hate you, but I'm trying to figure out the most polite way to say it. So Rosario Gabriel, someone you might be familiar with, she has suggested that instead we say, love the sinner, hate our own sin. Which I feel like is a pretty good substitution for what we do. And protection can sometimes even involve getting involved, like if you have spheres of influence on campus or in certain places where you can speak up or work towards the protection and dignity of LGBT people, that's an appropriate thing for Christians to do. It's an appropriate thing. Especially people in the transgender community, especially transgender people of color, are still so vulnerable to violence and to other types of abuse. And I don't want you to hear that they are only thing about them is just that they're sad abuse people. That's not true. But it's true that they're vulnerable. And the way that Christ interacts with the vulnerable is to draw near and to be gentle and to protect. He actually only had harsh words for the religious self-righteous. If you want to be like him, you've got to learn from him this way. I think it can be hard for us, some of us in this room too, because on some level, there has never been a better cultural moment to be queer, right? It's popular news programs, during Pride Month, all these corporations who you think, it's like a company that sells paint cans, which sort of says that anything to do with sexuality at all, but they've got the rainbow flags, and when we didn't do so well as America in the Winter Olympics a couple years ago, we were just excited that we had the gay leader standard because he was great, you know? And it can feel like, oh, everything's so great. And a lot of stuff has been helpful in terms of humanizing LGBT people. But on the ground, LGBT individuals, especially youth, are still extremely vulnerable. What does it mean for us to protect in that way? We've got to invite, listen, protect, and then invest. So if you've got someone in your life who trusts you and wants to walk with you, how can you build into that person so that they thrive? Whether or not they're in Christ. But then also, especially if they do want to give their life to Christ, how gifts and the beautiful opportunities of those in crew and in the church who experience any such attraction. I'm not the only one, even in this room, who's on staff, who experiences this. We are already with you on the mission field, already with you serving. What could it do if we created a culture where we didn't really have to hide, but we could be open? Wouldn't LGBT people who are not yet reconciled be able to see that and say, oh, maybe the gospel could be good news for me? Or maybe crew could be a place where I could serve and use my gifts. I think we could become that kind of place. I hope we could become that kind of place. In all honesty, the damage that the church has done has been happening over decades and is really deep. We're not going to turn this ship around in the next 5 minutes, right? But I do think we have an opportunity to honor the Lord. I do think some of us want to know, well, what exactly could I do so that this all goes right, right? We have to remember, Jesus did everything with perfect motivations and with perfect actions, and he killed him. But if we are his people and we follow in his footsteps, we will be misunderstood, we will be abused, it will still be worth it to show the grace and truth of our Lord to people who need it. And we all need it, right? Same grace and truth over time, all of us need that. But on the clock, so we can stay right at the top. Okay, so we have, you know, approximately 12 minutes for questions, and I can't see you, so I'm going to have to, by faith, just point. That's a good time to ask you questions. You already can't send me in with your England, so. Oh, yeah, so he was asking about what does it mean to reach out and reach the transgender community. So, I think one thing we need to remember is that trans people are people who are made in God's image and who are delighted to be friends with, right? So I think one level is just actually recognizing that I can approach you like any other person, have a relationship with you, talk with you. Because if they're not a Christian, you know, we want to get them the gospel. So they only, if you've got trans people in your life, you're just like, hey, I'd love to get to know you. I'd love to hear more just about your whole life. And I think on some level, too, if they're willing to be your friend and they know you're like a queer person, right? That's already a great part. I think in that case, usually I wait for them to bring up a conversation about sexuality and gender. Because I don't want to necessarily seem like I have an agenda, like, here's a thing about you I have to fix. I want to give them the opportunity to be reconciled to their Creator, which has to do with their sin, not about how they're feeling in relationships with gender and whatever way they're trying to find to just find some peace in the world, you know? So I think if we do have that conversation eventually, we can absolutely affirm that God made male and female. He made them good. We also know we live in a fallen world, right? So male and female have not been carried out often in healthy ways. Sometimes we create these weird stereotypes around what they're supposed to be. There's been a lot of oppression of women. I think about even St. Augustine just said that women weren't defective men. Well, thanks. That's great and unbiblical. So sometimes even as we're thinking about, okay, well, my transgender friend accepted Christ, how do I help them walk? It's just saying, you know what? We want to get people to a point where they can see that God created male and female good. But also, biblically, there is a lot of space to live in the world in a way that honors God as a male or female. It doesn't have to necessarily look stereotypical. You've got to recognize that people, who, especially people who experience gender dysphoria, especially fight all the way up until they go and meet the Lord, right? This isn't something that's going to change in a day. It's going to take patient walking over time. But if they know God who loves them, not just an abstract thing about what boys should be or what girls should be, but a God who made them and sees them and knows them, and who's promised that in the new heavens and new earth, he's going to give all of us new bodies that we don't feel alienated with, that aren't going to break, that aren't going to get old and die, I think that we can work, we just, you guys get through how can we love John Deere. I think that's one of the best ways. Okay, how about here?
Ministry partners have a daughter that's married, and before their fifth anniversary, he came out as transgender. Mm-hmm. So how should she relate to him and
to her
husband, who's now transgender?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is really hard. So what she was talking about, so it's a ministry partner's daughter who was finding the treaties, right, like we were talking about. So it's a woman who's married to a man, and now the man is living in the world as a woman. Mm-hmm. Is that okay?
Yes.
So this can be really difficult, right? Because all of us who've been married, you're probably looking at me, you're 18, I'm actually 34. I thought I'm married almost 12 years, so like more than a minute. We have all of us experience if we're married that we're not necessarily married to the exact same person who we said I do to at the altar, right? Things about us change. But to have someone suddenly say, well, I want to live in the world as a completely different gender than the one you married, and that would be understandably quite difficult for the spouse. And one of the things we need to do to care for both couples is, you know, if they are Christian, to affirm their faith identity and to come around them and figure out what they both need. I do think ultimately that what we would like to see in a disciple's life is that that Christian person finds some way to live in the world with the sex they've been given by God. But what I worry is that that truth could get crammed down somebody's throat pastorally, and change should be demanded really quickly or really sensitively. So what I would like to see is that a wonderful group of support comes around that couple and helps them figure out why the spouse feel like this was the best move. Right? Clearly there's something in his life that he needs. Maybe he hasn't received from church. How can we care? How can we get him to a place of health where he could feel comfortable again living with sex God gave him? But again, that might take a long time. And the wife of the church, they're also going to need a lot of support. However, if one of them is no longer a Christian, doesn't claim that anymore, both of them, then again, we're relating to non-Christians. And so we're going to figure out how to teach the gospel, provide support along the way, but try to get that person back there to a place of reconciliation with God. So we're really thinking most of this conversation, whether or not someone's a Christian, would change their pastoral response. And if someone claims to be a Christian, we do not need to be theology police. We want to take them seriously, and as their brothers and sisters, look at scriptures together and decide together, okay, so how do we understand what God's saying and what is good? How do we figure out how to live in that direction?
How would you recommend coming alongside our church bodies that, you know, as staff members, we get a lot of input and education and learning to grow and how to engage in these hard conversations, but helping our church bodies as well to not think we're not so crazy in the midst of this?
Yeah, but I think that's great. You said, how can we help our church bodies be better places? I'm a huge fan of materials. So if you have an opportunity, I want you all to write this down on Google so you don't forget it. There's a man named Preston Sprinkle. It's a ridiculous name. And he is exceedingly handsome, even though he's a theologian. He's like almost amazing. So Preston Sprinkle runs the Center for Faith, Sexuality, and Gender, or Gender and Sexuality. I always forget the words in. And Preston's website has a ton of excellent resources. And one of the best is this small group curriculum. There's two parts, Grace and Truth 1.0, Grace and Truth 2.0. 1.0 is five conversations about really LGB. So it comes with great video material. It's got excellent teaching, awesome discussion questions. And you could, in your churches or in your staff teams, be like, hey, does anyone want to spend 5 weeks going through this? His teaching on this is so good. And then Grace and Truth 2.0, And again, if you go to STACWA, Rhode Island Farm, has an LGBT, there's great resources that you can also share with people. So there's a free page for just to tackle the resources you can share with your ministry partners, with your churches. There's so many resources on this. I intentionally tried to make that page really just simple so you're not overwhelmed, but really good stuff. So I would say go there, start passing things out. And let's go over here. Okay.
What are some ways a crew on campus can reach out to and maybe partner with LGBT clubs that are on campus?
Yeah. We're talking about campus community, like how do we reach out? I think one of the best ways is to actually work together with LGBT groups on things that they care about. And to be like, well, we want to learn from you. So if you've got very mature student body, you can actually send some of your student leaders through ally training. It'd be a great way to strengthen your body and communicate some care. A lot of campuses will do things like the Trevor Project, which helps to reduce LGBT suicidality. So you can partner with events like that. Like just go ahead and ask those groups, like, hey, what do you care about? Because we care about you. You don't have to sacrifice doctor to do that. Like, at all. You're just saying, oh, we care about you, so we care about the things that you care about. And that can be a great way to just build relationships and learn about this population on the campus. Because sometimes you have very little contact with them. And so coming in as a learner, coming in humble, coming in excited to serve can be a great way for us to experience transformation and also maybe eventually for opportunity to gospel.
One of the things younger staff need to realize and older staff like me as well is that all churches have an inherent authority or cultural structure. And that you need to begin to think about what that structure is and how it looks like, because going to the wrong person could shut you off forever. So it's like you said, building relationships with some of the staff, just in the sense of learning how things work. The biggest concern for me is that in Archer, we've had an elementary school where one of our campuses is, where the school board decided to have open bathrooms, bathrooms for little boys that decided to identify as girls. And the brouhaha that developed out of that in this particular city was, of course, magnified by the media coverage. And what you did is you had Christians on one side, by and large, talking about God says and the Bible says, and our culture doesn't care about those two words. And then you had those who were being compassionate. So there was this separation. So being sensitive, careful, and relational in your church will only bring you kudos.
Yeah, I'm not very nice too. The culture war is over, we lost. And I think Christendom learning to grammar is going to be good for us because the gospel does really well when Christians aren't in power. So sometimes we can get anxious because we're worried that not being in power, not going to be shown mercy. And I think we have good reason to think this, because when we were in power, we did not show mercy. But we know that the gospel advances in suffering, advances in weakness, and advances through love. So I think our cultural moment isn't one to fret over, it's actually one to be missionally excited about. And let me see how much time I have. 10 minutes? No, we're done. We're done. Oh, yeah, sorry.